Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the future of work and employment, getting by the growing pains of a new world of jobs. My guest from the United Kingdom is Dr. Gwen Dyer. Gwen is a UK-based Canadian journalist and a columnist, author, world-renowned historian on international affairs. He holds a doctorate in military and Middle Eastern history from King's College in London, and a past service record in the American, British, and Canadian navies. In the past, he has taught war studies at the Royal Military Academy in the United Kingdom. He has been a syndicated columnist for over 20 years, and he has written several important books, including Climate Wars and his earlier book, War, which was the basis of a television series aired on the BBC and PBS. His most recent book is Growing Pains, The Future of Democracy and Work, which outlines some of the greatest social and political threats in our globalized world that we're facing in the future. His website is gwynnedyer.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here, Gary.
I was looking at a Pew Research survey published at the time of the last presidential election, 2016. This prioritized the electorate's leading concerns and worries. And first was the economy and jobs. That was 84% of people's concern. Then terrorism at 80%, followed by foreign policy, health care, and gun control. Climate change and the environment, which I might list as the top issue we should be most worried about, was 12th. Roughly at 50%. It would make sense that the economy is the number one worry, since unemployment is still very high, irrespective of the ridiculous figures they're using at 3.8%, when we have 103 million Americans who have work, could work, but are not working, and they're excluded from the statistics. So when you consider how many people are working part-time, and if you're working two jobs, you're actually listed as two full-time employees. So the official figures are completely wrong. The actual number of people unemployed goes between 17 to 22%. Now, if we had to tell the world we had 22% unemployment, then we would be looking at Italy and France, and we would no longer be able to brag to the world that look at our economy, look at our democracy, look at our capitalist society. We are a model. And what we're also looking at today, and this is something from the United Way, recently did a large study called ALICE. It looked at those who are employed but can barely make ends meet, such as paying rent and having enough left to eat each month. They are 43% of working Americans today. One single crisis in their lives, such as a sickness, would wipe them out. And already there are 47 million Americans without health care. As you said when you were on the noon show last month, the jobs are not coming back. Trump can't bring the jobs back, and so far there's no real indication it even desires that by giving more tax breaks to the wealthy. So picking up where we left off before, go into detail into the economic political forces underway that are hindering job growth now and will continue to do so in the future, particularly with the automation of jobs and the whole new field of artificial intelligence that the Chinese and Japanese are both excelling at. And I've seen some prototype videos of what they're doing, or videos of prototypes, and it's going to devastate a whole lot of professions. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you, Gary. The first thing to say, I think, is that Bruce Springsteen was right 20 years ago or 30 years ago when he was talking about the situation in New Jersey when he was growing up, and it was already the jobs are gone, boys, and they're not coming back. And I'm afraid that's the situation now in much larger parts of the country. And you're quite right, the official unemployment figures are nonsense. They're not massaged, they're brutalized. You know, there's you couldn't get them down to 3.8% without using an axe. The true numbers, as you say, are much higher. And in the Rust Belt, which is essentially where Trump won the election in 2016, they're undoubtedly a good deal higher than the 17 to 22% figure that you quoted just now. Unemployment numbers are tricky because lots of people have part-time jobs. Lots of people are what you call the working poor. You were just referring to them, people who do have jobs, maybe have two jobs, but are not making enough to get by, even the working poor. And numbers of people who, for example, have ended up on disability pay because they do have some kind of disability. They really could work with it, but it is bad enough that they can, you know, when there's no jobs to be had, you can go on that, and it's better than being on welfare because you get it automatically. You don't have to prove you're looking for a job or something. So coming up with a number is really quite hard. The best way to do it is to simply do an opinion poll style survey and ask everybody in that sample, were you working last week? And the answer to that is not 96.2% yes, it's about 83% yes, which is 17% no, we're not working. We would be working if we could, but there's no jobs. And Trump did spot that. I mean, he's, he may be a one-trick pony, but it's a good trick. He spotted that unemployment was the real problem, that jobs were the number one issue in a great many Americans' lives, especially when you have, I guess you might call it, a fairly rudimentary welfare state. I mean, once upon a time, the U.S. led the world, you know, Franklin, Roosevelt, New Deal. Even before the Second World War, there was an American welfare state being built. But it now lags far behind anybody else's in the developed world, and so it's really hard to be poor in the United States and extremely hard to be unemployed, more so than in other countries. So there's a lot of bitterness, there's a lot of anger, and Trump has figured out how to mobilize that and basically took the Rust Belt states away from the Democrats, who had always had them before. I mean, this was the most unionized part of the country, assembly lines everywhere, and that's how he got into office. He, however, did not identify what was killing the jobs correctly. He's barking up the wrong tree. We're in the middle right now of this trade war he's launching, a trade war which is motivated by the belief, or at least the story, I don't know if he really believes it, that the reason the jobs have vanished, the jobs that the official figures don't recognize are gone, but everybody knows they are, why did they go? The story is the foreigners stole them. Or unpatriotic American owners exported them, fired Americans, moved the factory to Mexico, reopened it down there, paid people $3 an hour instead of $25 an hour to make the same cars, and free trade, the demon free trade, allowed those factories in Mexico then to sell the cars in the United States as though they had been made in Detroit. And so his enemy is free trade. That's how he's going to solve the problem, which he has accurately identified, jobs. But that's not what's really killing the jobs. I mean, he's right now on his way, or will be on his way very shortly, to the G7 summit, the seven biggest industrialized countries. It's in Canada this year. And the other six leaders there are going to be begging him to stop this trade war he's starting, because they know he's barking up the wrong tree, but he will not admit, maybe does not understand, that the real problem is automation. It is computers, it is robot arms and AI, artificial intelligence, and a whole technology that is gradually eliminating the jobs that we have relied on since the start of the Industrial Revolution to provide money for people since we are in a cash economy, once you've got the Industrial Revolution, you get a job, you get paid, and you live a reasonable life. It gets better with time as we get wealthier, and you know, the working conditions get less horrible. It's not 10 hours a day, 7 hours a week, it's 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. But that model is crumbling. The jobs are not there anymore. The reason the Rust Belt became the Rust Belt, remember, it was one of the richest areas of the United States. 10, 20 million good industrial jobs paying good wages, unionized jobs, mostly on assembly lines of various sorts. That's the whole heartland of American industry there. Even 30 years ago, a rich part of the world. And now, desperate. I mean, you go to Cleveland, you go to Milwaukee, you go to Detroit. Chicago's escaped the curse. It's big enough. It sort of floated free. But everything else in the Rust Belt is a disaster area. And the reason is that the automation simply took the jobs. They didn't go to Mexico. Most of them didn't go to China or anywhere else abroad. They simply were abolished by machines in place. And that's inexorable. I don't see how you stop it. It's just too attractive to owners and managers to automate. I mean, you know, first of all, obviously, you have to pay the workers. You don't have to pay the machines that replace them, which is profit. But beyond that, it's so much easier to manage machines than human beings, who are, you know, difficult. They want washroom breaks. They want lunch breaks. They expect 2 weeks annual paid holiday. Lowest annual paid holiday in the entire developed world, only 2 weeks, but at least it's something. And they expect, you know, a pension when they retire. They expect all sorts of things. If they get mangled in an industrial accident, they might even sue the management. Machines do none of those things. They work as long as you want. You don't have to pay them. They never complain. Why would you not automate? What's not to love about this from a manager's or an owner's perspective? So as the machines get better, as the automation gets cleverer, bit by bit, working its way up through the skill sets, the jobs are vanishing. You can't stop it, and it is going to go, if not the whole distance, a very long way. We're now at 17-22% unemployment, anywhere in there. I mean, it's fuzzy. We were probably around 10% 25 years ago, and we probably will be around 50% 20 years from now. Those are the predictions. There have been studies made, the famous one in 2013, 5 years ago now, which sort of did a sort of occupation by occupation survey of the whole U.S. labor market, not just some global figure. They sort of asked the, you know, taxi drivers and the cops and the airline pilots and the doctors and the ballet dancers and the belly dancers and the pole dancers, you know, what do you think your profession is going to look like, occupation, in 20 years' time? What proportion of the jobs will be lost to automation? You should know. You're on the inside. You may be making your own plans. What's the answer? And the global figure they came up with in that study was 47% unemployment, 47% of existing jobs gone in 20 years, 20 years from 2013. So we're talking about 15 years from now. 47% of jobs gone. I mean, it's a fuzzy number. You can't actually predict the future that accurately, but it gives you a very good idea of what ballpark you're playing in. This is a ballpark figure, I agree, and it might be only 35%. It might be 60%, but that's where you're sitting in 20 years' time, which means that your society is unrecognizable. There is no longer a reasonable expectation of a full employment life. But you're not poor. as a society, as an economy, you're not poor. The production continues. The goods are produced. The services are produced. The United States lost one-third of all its industrial jobs, manufacturing jobs, in the first 18 years of this century, since 2000. 5.5 million jobs gone. But production, the economy, increased. The machines are good at it. They do the jobs well or better than human beings, and don't complain. So we're not poor. What's happening is that the way we distribute the riches of our society to those who are part of the society is breaking down. It was always done by work, and you pay people, and that's how they can afford the riches of the society, which are being produced. And now the riches are still there, but the model of paying people for work is being undermined by the fact that the machines are doing the work. So we have to figure out somehow how to put money in those people's pockets, because if you don't, what you get is, well, in the first phase, things like Mr. Trump, and in the second phase, maybe things like Mr. Hitler. I'm not calling Trump a Nazi. He doesn't even have the philosophical capacity to be one. And he's not inclined that way anyway. I don't believe that for a moment. But desperate people will listen to extreme and implausible solutions and vote for those who propose them unless there's something better on offer. That's where we're sitting right now.
Okay, I appreciate your insights. I'd like to share some of my own and see if this makes sense to you. One of my friends is a financial advisor. He does not invest people's money. Rather, he gives some suggestions of how either to grow their money or to save money. He is finding more and more people want to save money because they're afraid. Now, my figures come from the federal government, and there are 10 million millionaires. With 4 people per family, it's 40 million. There's 17.2, let's round it off, 17 professional class. Now, they'll make, the very good ones will make up to $1 million, like a surgeon, a brain surgeon, an oncologist, but you're also including professors and CPAs, people who are lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, the professional class. That's 68 million when you include 4 people per family. Between the two, it's 108 million. So that's one-third of the American population are living at what we would consider a high upper middle class or a low wealthy class. These are the millionaires could have $1 million minus their real estate. Now, here's the new phenomena, and this is what no one's paying attention to, and I see this as an enormous problem, and it's right in front of us. I saw it when a restaurant opened up right near my building in New York City. And I was told you ought to go see what's going on in there. And it was 11 o'clock at night. Now, normally 11 o'clock at night, you don't have very many busy restaurants. This place was packed, young people in their 20s, 30s. And it was the menu was designer beers, $50 to $60 a beer. And a sandwich, a boar's head sandwich, was $80. And when I walked around this packed place, I saw an average of about 4 beers in front of a person. So I'm thinking, where do these people come from? What's their background that would allow them to go out on just a casual night and drop $400, $500? And how often are they doing this? And what else are they doing like this? And then I started to realize you have an enormous amount of wealth that is using their stocks as leverage. And this goes back to the 1920s, before the Great Depression, when people would buy stocks with 5% down, and then the company, the stock exchange company, would hold the rest until they would make their payments. These are margin purchases. But the professional class, what they're doing is they've been using their stock to buy other stock, and they keep in the equities market because it's been so lucrative. But Michael Hudson, Professor Michael Hudson and others, Greg Palast, people who are economists, people who have good reputations, they're explaining that this is going to end. It's overvalued. This growth is not helping open new factories or train people for more appropriate jobs for the future. It's people buying back their own, what is called treasury stock. They're buying back stock in their own companies to increase the value. With less stock in the market, because you're buying it back, the value of the stock you have goes up. And that's where they get their bonuses. And so everyone wants to ride this roller coaster. And my friend says, my goodness, Gary, if you only knew how much the stock market is based upon leveraging debt. And if this goes down, if there's a correction in the market, you're going to see the biggest crash in American history. Then I get this. A lot of millionaires were living up to every penny they were making. If they made $2 million, if they made $5 million, if they made $10 million, they spent that in a year. And their families developed the habit of whatever they wanted, we're rich, so let's just pay for it. You may be rich, but you're not very rich. You're not super rich, and you're not the 100th or 1,000th of 1% rich. Having a few million dollars today, the average person to retire needs about $3 million to maintain a quality of life not exorbitant and not extravagant, and most people couldn't write you a check for $1,000. So what they're doing is the lawyers, doctors, engineers, and accountants, they don't have the money that the rich have. So what they're doing is they're creating debt, massive amounts of debt, and they're having to work as hard as they can so their kids can go to the private school where the other kids go, and their dad's a millionaire, so he can just pay for their tuition, and he can pay for an apartment, and he can pay for them to go out and drink, you know, all the beer they want at $50 a bottle. This guy and this woman can't. But they don't want anyone to know they can't. These are also people who are socially mobile upwards. So they're up to their eyeballs in debt. Now, one of the most important or successful money managers in America is someone I know. And we were having this conversation working out together recently. And he said, Gary, I've never had this happen in my 30-year career. I said, what's that? He said, everyone that I know is now not able to maintain their lifestyle, so they're saying, will you help me sell a Rolex watch? What'd you pay for it? $70,000. Okay. He's able to get $9,000. They bought stuff that didn't hold their value, but they thought they had to have it, and so they've got all this junk assets. Not a few people, a lot of people. So when you start looking at how many people are leveraged who are wealthy, how many people are in debt to maintain a lifestyle, and you put those two forces together, any correction in the market at all, you're going to see an absolute economic collapse. Your thoughts?
Well, I must say that I don't live in the U.S., and I am well aware that people are leveraged to the eyeballs elsewhere as well. The amount of private debt is as great as the amount of government debt, or greater, in virtually every Western country. So I don't know people like that, honestly. But I know they're there, and I didn't realize quite how many of them there were. It's very dangerous if that's the case. But, you know, in a way, I agree with you, scary stuff. But also familiar stuff. I mean, you know, we have the precedent of the great crash of the 30s. We have the great recession of 2008. We know it goes up and goes down. And as who was it said, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming naked. You know, that happens a lot. I mean, that is the economic cycle will catch people out if they are overexposed, and suddenly all the tricks they have fail and they're bankrupt. That's not unfamiliar. what we're looking at now is unfamiliar. It's a change that's probably as great over the same kind of period of time, 40, 50 years, as the Industrial Revolution was when we came into the current model, late 18th, early 19th century, between about 1780 and 1840, thereabouts. The United States industrialized, Britain industrialized first, the United States almost immediately afterwards, then Germany and other countries, eventually Japan and so on. And in every case, what you did was you took the entire population off the land, where 90% of them lived as small farmers, peasants in Europe, owners in America, but doing the same work, self-sufficient, not hardly in the cash economy, moved them all into the cities, put them in factories and other service industries, and paid them cash, which they then paid rent and bought food with and so on, a complete change of the economic model. And it happened about, about 200 years ago now, or a little bit less in some places. And that model, which seems normal, seems ordinary, seems almost inescapable, how else could you do it, is actually only about 200 years old. And I think it's running out of space, running out of road. And that's a different issue. It's not just the economy going up, the economy going down, the sort of sine wave of the economy over a long period of time, recessions and booms and so on. That's business as usual. This is not business as usual. This is what I think the statisticians call a secular change. It ain't going back. It's not cyclical. It is a change in the mode of living, not just of production, but of living, in which in the future, most people will not be fully employed. But they'd better have money or you're going to hate the society they're in and you're in. So there's a problem we have to sort out here. How does a rich society ensure that its members are rich, or at least prosperous, when the model for putting money into their pockets collapses, which is what's starting to happen?
I appreciate your insight on that. Thank you. I have to bring up the domination of the military-industrial complex in the United States, because over 10% of jobs are related to military defense, and our defense budget is larger than the next 10 nations combined, although it is still rather a small amount of the gross domestic product, although I feel gross domestic statistics have become near useless as indicators of national wealth or illness. In addition to defense workers employed by the government, including military personnel, there are several million more working in the private defense industries that survive on defense contracts, over 200,000 in the Washington, D.C. and Virginia area alone. The military weapons, the technologies devoted to defense and intelligence, is America's main industry, and war is becoming our leading profitable export. What does this portend to you for where the United States is heading economically and also its place in the global community?
Well, the United States is not unique historically. The greater the power economically of a country, the likelier it is to have lots of involvement in wars. And, the idea that great power makes you safe is the opposite of true. Great power guarantees that you will be involved in great power wars. Look at Sweden. When it was a great power, when it was one of the three or four strongest countries in Europe, it actually fought wars. It hasn't fought wars now for 120 years because it's, only 10 million people on the periphery of Europe. And it's very prosperous, but it doesn't fight wars. It's not in the game anymore. So being the world's greatest economic power with huge interests overseas does pretty well guarantee that the United States will be at war practically all the time. Just like Britain was during the century it was top dog. There was always a war going on somewhere, Zululand, Afghanistan, whatnot, and of course continental wars against the other great powers as well, which were the big wars. The United States mercifully has not fought another great power for 70 years now, which is a very good thing, long may it last, but it is continuously involved in wars. Now, the question you're really asking is, are those wars caused in order to justify, waged in order somehow or other to justify the enormous size of the American defense industry and the employment it provides? I don't know, is the answer to that. I mean, this is a bit of a chicken and egg question here, because actually, if you think about it, all you need to justify an enormous defense industry is the threat of war. You don't ever actually have to fight one. You know, it's you just, you know, have a threat. I mean, back in the days of the Cold War, every late winter, about February, the U.S. government would discover a Russian division or something in Cuba, because that was when Congress was going to look at next year's budget, and the military budget, and you needed a threat. It didn't matter if there was or wasn't a Russian division in Cuba. The threat was enough. The budget went through. Everybody's comfortably employed and making money for another year. So, you know, in at least theoretical and, you know, in principle, you don't need the wars, just the threat of war, in order to justify the military spending. And actually, when you think about it, most of the money that's spent on weapons is spent on weapons that are hardly ever used in war. I mean, the wars the United States actually fights tend to be on the ground, in the desert, in the jungle, in poor countries, mostly with infantry. Yes, I know they've got drones dropping things in people's heads and so on, but no aircraft carriers. I mean, they can wheel an aircraft carrier in and provide a little bit of justification for it, but frankly, you've got air bases there anyway. You don't need an aircraft carrier for that. The big defense expenditure, the F-35 and the 13 aircraft carriers that will all have to be replaced in the next, you know, few decades. So that's a lot of razor blades when you tear up the old ones, but you'll beat them, you know, put them into new ones. That the threats that justify that have not ended in war for 70 years. They're great power threats: China, Russia, you know, which, you know, objectively have no particular reason to go to war with the United States. They're not trying to export an ideology. They're not fanatics. They have no territorial disputes with the United States. Why? But they're all doing this. And certainly the permanent threat of war provides enormous numbers of jobs, provides enormous amount of employment. Does it actually cause the wars? I suppose it creates a mindset that facilitates the wars, but you don't actually have to fight the wars. I mean, if you look at, you know, during the 10 years that the United States was neck deep in Vietnam, 90% of the defense budget went elsewhere, to the Cold War, the confrontation with the Soviet Union, which never ended up in a war at all. So, I'm not quite sure. Chicken and egg, like I said.
Okay. I want to return to our conversation about artificial intelligence that we unfortunately ran out of time to finish last time. Today, 1/3 of Americans have a college degree, just over 33%, whereas a decade ago it was 28% and only 5% in 1940. Yet it is higher among those under the age of 34, at around 37%. Yet there are not enough jobs available that are aligned with their level of education. And you have said that it will be the white-collar jobs that are being threatened by artificial intelligence. So share how artificial intelligence is being used in the workplace today and explain why it will be replacing the white-collar jobs that require a college degree. And also, I heard an audio tape of a law firm that specializes in bringing in special, highly educated people, generally from India, South Korea, and other countries, on visas, and they are taking the place of highly skilled and senior employees in companies, and frequently those same employees, in order to get their bonuses or to get anything, must first teach the people who are taking their jobs. Now that, just on the emotional level, you know, working with someone where you're making $150,000, you've worked there 25 years, and they're going to make $50,000, and you can't blame them, but you look at what we've become, and this is really very common and never really discussed or exposed.
Yeah, well, that's why we have laws. And the thing is, the laws are not being made that would prevent that sort of thing from happening. It's not brain surgery here. The AI, of course, artificial intelligence, which is just another way of saying very intelligent computers that are capable of dealing with less repetitive, more complex, sometimes surprising situations than the early generations of computers, which could simply repeat rote activities that did not change in an environment that was not changing around them. Now you've got computers that can deal with all that increasingly, and of course they are taking jobs that were invulnerable 20 years ago because, you know, you could not get somebody to figure, you know, you could not find a machine 20 years ago that would, for example, be able to examine an insurance claim and decide what the payout will be, considering the law, considering precedent, looking at the contract that was signed when they bought the insurance, and come up with an answer, you know, you can't claim that, here's a bid for that, and so on. That had to be done by human beings. Now, artificial intelligence, though it actually cannot do poetry yet, can do that. And so those jobs are starting to go. The people who are being brought in on visas to replace folks who are doing complex jobs like that, that are not purely repetitive, are actually just a bridge to a future where they will lose their jobs too, because the machines will do them. You know, that's it's reprehensible. You know, God bless them, they need a job and they got lucky and now they're earning $50,000 a year and not living very well on $50,000 a year because they're in the United States. The way you deal with that is, that's not AI taking over, that's the government not regulating who can come and live in this country and work. I mean, you know, we always had this kind of rules, and the fact that they're being broken more and more because business gets what business wants, regardless of what happens to the people they used to employ. But, you know, you can fix that with legislation. You can't fix the AI with legislation, not in the long run. You might be able to ban it for a little while in certain jobs, but in the end, it's going to get in because it doesn't actually make sense to insist on people doing jobs that machines can do. I mean, you know, we did not insist on, you know, nobody can buy a combine harvester. The hay has got to be brought in with scythes. You know, there were people trying to argue that back at the beginning of the agricultural revolution. And the consequence of letting the combine harvesters and the tractors and so on into agriculture was a 90% fall in employment in that industry. But it just didn't make sense to have all these people doing, you know, basically stoop work, stoop labor, when the machines can do it. So you're not going to stop that. You can stop people infiltrating into the system and stealing other people's jobs at the behest of some owner, but you can't stop the technological change. And really, you can't justify stopping it. There must be a better way of ensuring that these people have the money they need as American citizens to live and thrive in this society without insisting they do mind-bendingly boring labor that doesn't need to be done because a machine could be doing it. I mean, I will not defend that kind of argument. That's, I think, called Luddism.
Our democratic model of domestic and national governance, now fully built upon our free market capitalist economic system in the United States, it's broken. Yes. Our democratic model is broken. Our domestic and national governance system is broken. And as you noted in your blog, The election of Trump is a clear indication of this. And also in other countries, we are seeing a rise in right-wing nationalist parties. The neo-Nazis now have seats in the German parliament. We're witnessing
nationalistic opposition in the German parliament.
Yeah, yeah, and we're witnessing nationalist extremism on the rise in the Netherlands and UK and France, Italy, even earlier in Greece and elsewhere. Can you draw some associations between the rising trend in extreme nationalism with the failures of modern democracy that tries to preserve within a capitalist system what is supposed to be some sense of equality? And gerrymander once said on this program that democracy and capitalism are incompatible. And Noam Chomsky has said the same thing. Your views about this?
Capitalism is a mode of production. It is not in itself a political system. It operates within a political system, which it may take over, but it doesn't have to. And in many countries over long periods of time, it has not. You do have to make compromises with the existing technology and the existing shape of the economy. Absolute equality is really not available in a modern economy without the degree of repression that is intolerable. I mean, you know, that's what the communists tried to do, institute absolute equality. And it sounded like a sweet idea at the time, but you actually had to control everybody's behavior with secret police and jails and gulags and all the rest of it in order to enforce that kind of equality. Can't be done. So, or it shouldn't be done. So we have all kind of agreed to live in a society of managed inequality. There will be some inequality, but we will have equal political rights, and we will not be so far apart economically that we have become two separate castes of people. And there will be possibilities of moving up and down, not just up, but also down within the pecking order. But the gap between the rich and the poor will never be allowed to grow so great, nor will the poor be allowed to grow so poor that it becomes intolerable. That way lies revolution, of course, and things of that sort, or repression. But capitalism, would I love to smash capitalism? I don't know, because I don't know what would replace it. But I know that I'm not going to smash capitalism, and I know that I do not need to smash capitalism in order to live in a reasonably fair and just society. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of things you've got to do to fix the justice part of it. The American justice system is broken for reasons that have nothing to do with capitalism. But you can arranged to have a society. Many countries for long periods of time in the 20th century, including the United States, have had societies. The United States did between the end of the Second World War and about 1980, societies where there isn't a huge gap between the rich and the poor, and where everybody is doing reasonably well, and where there is effective democracy. Those things went off the road about 30 years ago in the United States, almost 40 years ago now. And getting them back on the road will take a long time, but I don't think it requires smashing capitalism. A good idea in practice, perhaps, but not one that's available, and maybe not even a good idea in principle. Just don't allow it to rule the roost. Don't allow it to take over your politics. Do not allow it to buy the Congress, as somebody once said. You know, it's the best Congress money can buy. But it doesn't have to be like that. Can I use the last few minutes just to say something about where we are now and where we need to go, I think?
Yes, please. Yes.
What the reaction to Mr. Trump's election has been to realize that we are at some sort of turning point. The jobs really are not going to come back, and you may end up with a future society that resembles Blade Runner if you don't get on top of this change and steer it in the right direction. You know, sort of a privileged minority and an essentially enslaved majority, although they don't wear chains, and impoverished. You don't have to do that. And the hopeful consequence of the panic and the recognition of a completely changed situation that Mr. Trump's election created has been that a lot of people have begun looking into the question of what some people call a guaranteed income, some people call it a basic income, which is to say a guarantee that nobody in the society, employed or unemployed, will fall below a certain level of income which is sufficient to lead a modest but comfortable life. We're rich enough to afford that. And, you know, there's no means test. And, of course, you can still have your job. You can become a millionaire if you want, and you're good at it. But you cannot fall below, let us say, $35,000 a year for an individual or $50,000 a year for a family. That money, you know, if you're making less than that, we'll bring it up to there. And I don't say that would solve all the problems, but the idea of a basic income will prevent a lot of the problems from going toxic. And there are tests, pilot programs being run in 5 or 6 countries right now, looking into that very prospect. Seeing, you know, to answer questions like, okay, if you give people that money, will they still go out and work? Because we need lots of people still to go out and work, less as time goes by, but, you know, we still need far more than half of them to be employed. Will they get out of bed in the morning if you're giving them $35,000 a year? And the answer, I don't know, but let's try it. Let's give a bunch of people that money and watch what they do. I think it would be all right. They'll want more, and they'll get jobs if they can find them, and, you know, that, then it'll be fine. But we need to run the test. And that's what's being done now. Sort of, there's one going on in the state of California, not funded by the government, by the way, of California, but by the people in Silicon Valley, the Bill Gateses and Elon Musks and Mark Zuckerbergs and so on. They're all involved personally, which is testing what, you know, how will Californians who are given $1,000 a month for nothing and allowed to earn money too, will they still show up for work? That, you know, it's a test. There's a bigger one being done in Canada. There's some being done in Europe. I don't know if this is the answer, but something like this is probably going to be the answer if we are going to avoid Blade Runner.
Okay. I want to expand a little bit on that. What if around the world, there are certainly countries that are more socialistic, more interested in the quality of life, like Nepal, which has one of the highest qualities of life and joy of living percentages in the world, but the United States, not so much. You see, I'm looking at three things that are coming together in a very unfortunate way. I see the highest rate of illnesses, diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and cancer, and in the world per population. I just finished a major documentary on this, and that's not going to change. You simply can't get people to prevent disease, no matter how hard you try. I've been at it for a long time. Separately, you see those who have the power to manipulate the markets, the hedge fund managers, the equity partnerships, those who have that inside knowledge are exploiting it without any concern of the consequences to other people. The bail-in, in case any, there's another disaster, is proof of that, where Obama signed the year before he left in December that if there's another failing economy, the banks will get first bid to get out of jail without any repercussions. We will once again bail them out, but not individuals. So we see the economic landscape changing. I'm looking at the amount of debt, credit card debt, mortgage debt, car debt, school debt, and medical debt that the average person is paying. When you got 235 million Americans living just at above or below the poverty level who don't have $2,000 to their name, one disaster and they're in serious trouble. So yes, that's another problem. Then the last problem is climate change. I've done a great deal on climate change. We've done more specials, more commentaries on climate change than any other radio or television program in the world in the last 5 years, hundreds, and no one seems to be paying attention in the United States. Small groups and individuals, yes. Some countries are taking it much more seriously. But in the United States, because the power of the media and because of who controls much of our body politic and the media, we're not told how serious it really is. We're not told by a climatologist and one of the best in the world just last week, that we only have 5 years left to make major Marshall Plan changes, or we will be in extinction mode from that point forward. And then gave him all the explanation. There are 14 other leading scientists and climatologists who agree with him. So we're on a short track to finding parts of the world no longer habitable. For example, just yesterday, there was more rain in France in 1 hour than there would normally be in over a month. We have these new super rains now. And already this week, just this week, yesterday, there was an effort to try to create a new Category 6 hurricane because the climatologists believe that we're going to see the first Category 6, meaning 190 miles an hour up from there. So on the one hand, I have a ranch, a recovery ranch for animals in Florida. I saw the power of a Category 4 that hit us just 9 months ago. I saw what it did to every home in the whole area and the trees and the shrubs. We get hit with a Category 5, it's over. First, no one can afford the insurance. Many times insurance, even when I was fully insured, fully, and paid every single time for 26 years, my insurance company offered me 3%. I fought it. I've been fighting it now. It'll be another year before I finally get recovery on this. What if you're the average person and you don't have that insurance, or you don't have the means to fight it, and you're without electricity, and you're without, you know, air conditioning and water, the very things that happened for 3 months, 3 months. So now we're going to see that's the new norm, 12,000 unique and exceptional weather events in the last 12 months alone in the United States, over 120,000 unique weather events around the world. So we're not paying attention to the environment and the consequences to us. We're not paying attention to society. It just doesn't collapse all at once. It collapses in parts. We're the green zones where if you're very wealthy, you're not going to have a concern. If you're poor, you will. And this also means a lot of people are not going to be able to afford the food that is available. And a lot of places, because of global warming, will not be able to grow because a 3-degree increase in temperature will prevent a lot of seeds from germinating, meaning North Dakota, where we now grow a lot of our grains and rice in particular, and the Kansas, and we're also running out of water. So instead of dealing with the environment, dealing with income inequality, and jobs and everything else that that's associated with, dealing with our health problems, we're dealing with none of this. So what is the likelihood that we'll be humanistic enough, spiritual enough, to look and say, friend, you don't have to ask me, can you spare a dime? I consider your life important also, and we're going to provide you with some form of guaranteed subsistence to help you. In America, I don't see that happening. So what then would be the likely outcome when you have so many people poor, abandoned, and with the super rich and the wealthy indifferent to their plight?
A civil war, frankly. It's I didn't even mention climate change in this whole hour because, in fact, we were talking about something else. But as you know, we've spent an hour talking about this in your program on a number of occasions. The time is running out, and the consequences will be extreme. And we're not paying attention. The United States is particularly not paying attention because it's really the only place left where there is widespread disbelief that the problem is real. Elsewhere, people accept that it's real but aren't doing much about it because it isn't actually hitting them very hard this afternoon. But in the United States, there is actually a very large proportion of the population, it's sometimes less than half, sometimes even a bit more, which literally doesn't believe that there is a problem with the climate changing. They don't seem to believe the Earth is flat, but they're in a similar sort of position. And it's the workings of American politics, frankly, and obviously of American industry, which are the industries which would suffer if we acknowledge the seriousness of the problem, fossil fuel industries and so on. But they've got away with it, with denial and muddying the waters in the United States much more than they have elsewhere. But even in countries where they're really frightened and where the government gets it and nobody argues with the government, like China. China's terrified of climate change because they know what the future holds for them, and it's horrifying. I mean, you know, there's a study done about 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago now, funded by the World Bank, in which they hired a local Chinese think tank to do the study, do the due diligence, figure out how much food production China loses when the climate is only 2 degrees higher, average global temperature. Well, it's 1 degree higher now. We're halfway there. And the study came back and said China loses 38% of its food production. That's two-fifths. There, you know, that's famine, civil war, revolution. The Chinese government knows these numbers. They're terrified, but, so they're running as fast as their legs can carry them. And they put in half of the solar power installed anywhere in the world last year. You know, I mean, they really are. But they are also, and they're now starting to close down coal-fired power stations. But the problem is that, you know, you've got to make it through the future one day at a time, and tomorrow the lights must not go out, or you're out of a job. You're no longer the government. So you got to keep the lights burning, and that means that you can't close down all your fossil fuel power right now. And yes, you put in as much as you can that's clean power, but you go on polluting for a while because there's no practical alternative for the government starting from where they're standing now to get out of it in time to avoid further warming. And at the very best, if we are lucky and we respond very fast from here on in, and I don't actually see that happening, we will skid to a halt in terms of rising temperatures, you know, within a hair's breadth of the point you must never go past, the never exceed point, around 2 degrees higher average global temperature, because after that, it's runaway. You lose control. You trigger natural processes that reinforce the warming. You can't turn them off, and you're on an escalator heading upwards to, you know, 3, 4, 5 degrees higher average global temperature, which is mass death, which is billions dying. I mean, when you talk about things like this, it immediately gets surreal, and people think it's not possible that it could happen. Of course it can happen. You know, physics is not something you can argue with.
So what you are saying, and I agree, is that we must pay attention, we must become proactive and deal with these issues now and not expect someone else to do it for us. Thank you very much for being on. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to our next discussion.
I do too, Gary. Thank you.
And that is Dr. Gwynn Dyer. He is the author of Growing Pains, The Future of Democracy and Work. His website is gwynndyer.com. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.